Hi everyone, welcome to the Ali Houston Transforms podcast. I'm Ali Houston, health coach, food innovator and scientist. I survived years of weight problems, mental health issues, autoimmune diseases, surgery and even cancer. I turned my health around by diving into the scientific research, changing what I eat and what I do. I founded Paleo Canteen and the Ali Houston Transforms podcast to not only share this life-changing information, but to engage in a process of discovery and illumination with my guests and all of you. This podcast is made possible by paleocanteen.co.uk. Head over there after the episode. Transforming into being healthy is so much more than just a list of foods. It's a rich process of becoming that never stops. Head over to paleocanteen.co.uk or follow the link in the show notes to find out what I mean. And if you find this episode useful or interesting, please share it far and wide, or even just with a friend. Thanks, and enjoy the show. And we're recording, and I've got Brett Scher with me, which I'm delighted about. Hi, Brett.
Hi, Ali. Great to be here. Thanks for having me today.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I've followed you for a number of years. At the moment, you are the director of Metabolic Mind, and also, and how I originally know of you, you're a low-carb cardiologist, kind of generally promoting cardiovascular and metabolic health.
That's right.
It's really great to have you on because you've been such a clear, concise and credible voice in the low-carb community for years now. I think I first heard you on the Human Performance Outliers podcast, maybe 2018 or so.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That was a while ago.
Yeah, and you know, it's always really interesting when you hear someone who just has an air of careful scientific credibility about them make fairly bold statements about the power of using nutrition for health. Mm-hmm. I would say that characterizes kind of your professional energy, if you like. So maybe you could start off by just telling us a bit about yourself and how you kind of came to when I first heard you in 2018.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the intro and the opportunity. So, you know, I started as a cardiologist. I was always interested in prevention. My fellowship was a preventive and general cardiology combined. So I always wanted to focus on prevention of cardiovascular disease. But it didn't take long for me to realize that the system just wasn't working. The recommendations weren't working. The way we approach patients wasn't working for the majority of people. I had to like scratch my head and say, why? Why is this? And long story short, it led me on a path that sort of eventually led me to this whole concept of metabolic health. And everybody in medicine kind of knows metabolic health, but hasn't been giving it the recognition it deserves and the connection between metabolic and cardiovascular health for sure. People talk about type 2 diabetes and pre-diabetes, but rarely was that conversation really coming towards being one of the leading risk factors for cardiovascular disease. So that's where I really started to dive into. And that led me to low carb nutrition and ketogenic nutrition, because I was always interested in nutrition and exercise and lifestyle as therapeutic interventions. But the Eat Less, Move More campaign, which is what we're taught and what I unfortunately told my patients for years, is just failed or destined to fail. So the path down to low carb and keto nutrition really opened my eyes to what's possible for improving metabolic health and for helping people sustain a lifestyle that improves their health. So that led me down this whole world of really focusing on that and focusing on metabolic health. And then I became the medical director at dietdoctor.com, which is just a wonderful resource for keto and low carb. And then now transitioned just a few months ago over to Metabolic Mind, to take that focus of metabolic health over to mental health, which is so important and so impactful for so many people if they can improve their symptoms. And it's really sort of a nascent field. It's really in its infancy. So it's exciting to kind of be at the forefront of this field. And through all this, you sort of alluded to it. I think a big part of it is how we communicate science, how we talk to people about science and research. And that's another thing that I've really tried to focus on in addition to metabolic health is how we talk about that. Because it's so easy to say, look, a study shows this, therefore it must be true. Well, no, we see that all the time. You know, that's evidence-based research. But what's the quality of that study, right? Is it an observational study with very low hazard ratios and all sorts of methodological issues? Or is it a randomized controlled trial? And then if it is, what is the specific population looking at? What is the specific intervention? It's not enough to just say a study shows. We have to talk about the details. And that's a harder message to get across because the catchy headlines, you know, the sound bites, those are just the ooh, this research shows, but that just does more injustice than it does education, I think. And so we have to be better at communicating science to people so that they understand it and what it means to them, right? It's one thing to say there's a small effect in this huge population of people, but how do we boil that down to the individual person? Because that's what individual people care about, right? That's what I care about as a doctor. I care about my individual patient. I don't care about, you know, the huge population so much. I care about you, and you should care about you and your loved ones. And so it's that level of communication that's a little more challenging to do, but I think is so important.
Yeah, there's so many good points in there around a kind of capture that goes on. I think there's some people invoke a kind of cynicism or corporate capture of medicine, which undoubtedly there's a bit of. But on the other hand, I think there's an urge to specialize, which has allowed humans to thrive in many different ways, which sometimes can be detrimental, so that specialisms can be seen as islands unto themselves, whereas the metabolic picture tends to tie these things together. You know, David Unwin talks about telling some of his GP colleagues about the wins he was having reversing mm-hmm. symptoms of diabetes in his patients, and how he was deprescribing antidepressants and anti-anxieties too. And, you know, just seeing his colleagues nodding as if he must be delusional or making it up. And this, the M word, the metabolism that ties things together, maybe you could go more into that, because I think it's still a little bit of a mystery to some people. It basically means where we get our energy from, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it basically means how your body processes energy from the food you're eating. I mean, that's like one simple way to think about it. How efficiently your body is able to create energy from the inputs. And that's just not like, you know, how do you get energy to run or whatever. It goes down to a cellular level. How are the cells producing energy? And if you are not metabolically healthy, if you have insulin resistance, if you have metabolic dysfunction, and as we're learning, it goes all the way down to the mitochondrial level, the organelle in these cells, then you're suffering because your body is, it depends on what you're talking about. You can talk about from the muscles, you can talk about the brain, you can talk about your organs, but if it's not producing energy efficiently, then you're not performing in life as you could be. And it could manifest as type 2 diabetes, where you have diseased blood vessels as a result in your eyes and your kidneys and your heart and your legs. It could be manifest as mental illness, where your brain isn't creating, whether it's neurotransmitters or whether it's energy in the proper efficient way, or neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease and dementia, like similar concepts. Metabolism seems to kind of weave all of these together. Now, it doesn't mean like if you fix your metabolism, everything goes away, right? It's not that simple, but there is a clear connection between them. And insulin resistance, metabolic dysfunction is certainly strongly related to those conditions I mentioned. And treating it can certainly help in many, many instances. So I think it does have to elevate. We have to elevate it to the front of the conversation and no longer be sort of like that's related to diabetes. We'll worry about it when you get type 2 diabetes. No. It's time to address it, to screen for it, to address it, to catch it early, to treat it early. I mean, there was a great study by Dr. Natalie Rasgen at Stanford, where they looked at this big Dutch cohort and people who didn't have insulin resistance, didn't have depression, and they followed them over time. And those who developed insulin resistant were more than twice as likely to 2.5 times as likely to eventually develop major depression. And that was such a strong correlation. I mean, if that doesn't get your attention, then I don't know what does. I mean, this should be screened for and treated. And, you know, the skeptic in me says it's not, because it's not a drug treatment, right? We haven't been taught by drug reps and by big pharma research that this is the thing to do, because it's not a pill. It's what you eat. It's how you exercise. It's how you sleep. It's how you manage your circadian rhythms. Like, no one can package that and sell it and make billions. So big companies aren't promoting it. And that's what we're fighting against.
Yeah. Again, a lot in there. And, you know, you talk about how you can't package it and sell it, and how insulin resistance seems to be a marker, and also how, you know, how we communicate all this is really important. We have to outsource our expertise. It's just something we have to do to efficiently get on with our lives. You know, I always say none of us should be expected to be able to build our own iPhones, but we do want our iPhones. Mm-hmm. So similarly with this kind of expertise, a lot of people I talk to, a lot of people I coach, they don't really care if they ever understand what insulin resistance means. On the other hand, other people really do, and they want to get under the hood and see. But so that communication part is obviously vitally important. And I guess in a bit we'll talk about what metabolic mind is in that regard. But I mean, thinking about the correlation there, that you're 2.5 times more likely to develop, was it serious depression if you develop insulin resistance? Depression. So mm-hmm. 2.5 times is 250% more likely. You know, when you sometimes have recommendations made based on associational studies like that, where the hazard ratio is like, you know, 10% or 20%. So 250% is enormous. It's a very, very clear correlation, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, these observational studies with hazard ratio of 1.2 are pretty problematic, hard to interpret. But anything above 2 is certainly worthy of getting your attention. Now, if it's above 5, then you're starting to talk about, you know, more of a direct potential causative effect. But above 2 is certainly worthy of attention and worthy of further investigation and worthy of being elevated into the discussion about why is this happening? And if so, what are, you know, metabolic interventions we can use to try and prevent and treat this? And it's a logical discussion that should come from that type of finding. And that's what we're trying to do at Metabolic Mind. We're trying to elevate that discussion, to put that discussion on the forefront, to share resources and information about this intersection of metabolic and mental health. But I think you're right that, you know, everybody shouldn't expect to make their own iPhone. And everybody shouldn't have a PhD level of understanding of research, which is why it's our job, those who are who are communicators in this field, it's our job to communicate responsibly. And unfortunately, there are plenty who don't think about that. Not that they're trying to necessarily mislead people, but that level of nuance or understanding or detail in communication just isn't there. And that's doing a disservice to a lot of people who could use our help to simply understand those details that they're not trained. They're not trained to find out on their own.
Yeah. It's you know, there's a real urge that you can understand to oversell something in order to get people to try something because you know it might help them. But of course, like you say, it can really damage the progress of true understanding, because you're misrepresenting what is actually known. And that goes back to how I introduced you as someone who's very, you know, clear and careful about that sort of thing. Coming at it from a different angle, because some people probably think, well, I mean, it's fairly new science, maybe I'll just wait a little bit longer to see if anything else comes out. There's already some really interesting studies. And thinking about the first one would be Dr. Kalkin's study, you know, using mm-hmm. metformin, which is a generic drug used to treat type 2 diabetes typically. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that study? And can you maybe talk us through it if you are?
Yeah. So it's called the TRIO-BD study. I keep calling it the TRIO-BD, but it's a TRIO-BD study by Dr. Calkin and her colleagues up in Canada. And she took some of her patients that who are treatment-resistant bipolar. So not just with any bipolar disorder, but with a treatment-resistant bipolar disorder, which means they've been tried on multiple medications and their symptoms haven't improved. And she randomized them to a metformin or placebo. And metformin doesn't have really known psychological, psychiatric, mental effects, brain effects. It works in the liver and it improves insulin sensitivity in the liver. And what she found of those who took metformin and who improved their insulin resistance and they became insulin sensitive, their symptoms, their bipolar symptoms dramatically improved. Now, interestingly, those who took metformin whose insulin resistance did not improve, they did not see the same benefit in their bipolar symptoms. So very interesting. So it suggests it wasn't the drug itself. It suggests it was the reversal of the insulin resistance that then was correlated or caused, depending on how you look at it, the improvement in the bipolar symptoms. So that's pretty dramatic. I mean, that was pretty amazing because it was very clean. It was a very clean study, and the degree of association was very high. So that's pretty impressive. And then she had a secondary study, actually, in similar patients looking at brain imaging to see the blood-brain barrier, how leaky this blood-brain barrier is. So the blood-brain barrier is kind of what it sounds like. It's in your blood vessels, and it's to prevent, you could say, toxins and other things from getting from the bloodstream into your brain. But the more insulin-resistant somebody was, the leakier that blood-brain barrier was, and that also correlated with the specific phenotype for people who had worse symptoms of bipolar disease. So she's drawing a picture here with her research saying, okay, it's related to insulin resistance and possibly even related to blood-brain barrier. There could be a connection there, but it suggests that treating the insulin resistance improves bipolar symptoms, and that's what was really impressive. Now, what else can you do besides metformin? Well, that's where nutrition, specifically low-carb and keto nutrition, comes into play. That's where regular exercise, regular sleep patterns and circadian rhythms and all these things that address metabolic dysfunction and insulin resistance. So based on these findings, these should be frontline therapy for serious mental illness, whether it's bipolar disorder, major depression, schizophrenia. Doesn't mean they're the only therapy, right? Doesn't mean, oh, you don't need medications. You don't need any of these other things we've established in the field of psychiatry. But as an adjunctive therapy, why wouldn't you? Like, why wouldn't you try that? It just seems, certainly when you throw in the clinical experience of people like Dr. Georgia Ead and Dr. Chris Palmer and Dr. Shivani Sethi, when you throw in their clinical experience, I mean, these patients, they want to get better. And so why wouldn't you try this and recommend this alongside standard care? I think that's where we're headed.
Yeah, I haven't heard a good answer why you wouldn't. I think some people are mistaken about risks around low carb, but you've been very clear about that. I think you feel like you've bottomed out on the research there, not really found much in the way of dangers. But what might the points of care be around starting something like that if you already have mental illness?
Yeah, and that's a great point. And that's a point we try to make in our videos that we have up on our YouTube channel at Metabolic Mind, that this is not something you should do on your own if you're using it to treat a condition, any sort of psychiatric condition, if you're on psychiatric medications, even for treating type 2 diabetes. You probably should not be doing this on your own because there are some significant concerns. You know, when you start a ketogenic diet, you might feel worse before you feel better. It might disrupt your sleep. It can affect your medication levels. You know, there's that whole keto flu that people can go through. So you really should have professional guidance because sometimes you need an increase in sleeping medications if you have bipolar disorder or schizophrenia to make sure you don't get insomnia as you transition into keto. You might need an increase in your anti-mania or antipsychotic medications temporarily. And then things tend to get much better. That's what clinical experience, again, from people like Chris Palmer and Shivani Sethi and Georgia Ead, that they have found in others. So working with a trained professional is so important from that standpoint. You have to make sure your electrolytes are right and your hydration is right. and that you're following a well-formulated keto diet. So all these components that go into it. So it's a medical intervention, right? It's not a diet. This isn't the keto weight loss diet that so many people have found success for losing weight. This is a medical intervention that changes your body's physiology. You change from burning glucose primarily to burning fat primarily to producing ketones, which your brain can use for fuel. I mean, this is more powerful than most drugs that we give. So it should be treated like a prescription and followed like a prescription in hopefully a multimodality approach, working with your physician and a dietitian and maybe even a coach. And, you know, online coaching programs like what you're developing is going to be so important in this field. So, yeah, I mean, that's the other part of it. You know, we can say it should be first line therapy with standard of care, but it also has to be done with proper support. And that's what we can hopefully together just by talking about it more and building this enthusiasm about the science and the clinical experience that we can start to help people build this infrastructure to help patients, which is really what it's all about in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, going online is something I want to do to get to as many people as possible because, you know, digital scales well. The question is a large component of the success of the kind of support that online coaching can provide typically because you really do feel like you're getting someone's time. You know, similarly with a well treated patient, you know, sometimes it's partly because the doctor is really good and really nice. You know, do you have a feel for how scalable an accessible solution really is?
That's a great question. It's a question we're asking ourselves a lot in Metabolic Mind, and what role can we play to help others develop scalable solutions? And so I wish I had an answer now and I could say, yeah, it's easy. We could definitely do this. You know, it's not going to be easy, but it's absolutely doable. It starts with education, though, and that's where we're really trying to have this forward-facing education movement right now at Metabolic Mind, so that people out there looking for this understand it's a thing. They understand and can become educated that this is a potential, and give them that hope that maybe this will work for them and something that they can strive for. At the same time, helping clinicians understand that this is a way they can help their patients. So we want the patients to bring it to the clinicians. We want the clinicians to understand that this is a way to help. I mean, to hear Georgia Ead say, I've never had an intervention that has helped patients put their, you know, their psychiatric symptoms into remission. I've never had an intervention that's worked as well as this. I mean, that's just so dramatic to hear her say. And I don't know why every clinician wouldn't be like, huh. Well, if she's saying that, maybe it's something I need to look into too, because I'm tired of just giving drugs and giving drugs and giving drugs. Maybe there's a better way to do this. So to get the clinicians on board and get them interested and aware of it, and then it's the infrastructure, then it's the connection, because we have to be honest, even if a psychiatrist knows about it and is interested in about it, they don't have the time or the knowledge or the information to help someone start a ketogenic diet and walk them through all the things and, you know, really talk to them about exercise and sleep. That's where coaches come in. That's where nutritionists come in. So for psychiatrists to have that network of people to be able to send their patients to work together as a team, that's the ultimate goal. So I think that's absolutely doable. Not tomorrow, but it'll take some time, but we will get there. But it starts with this education movement. And that's really what we want to do right now to really forward that.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting to think about where it's going to lead because, like you say, I mean, it works really well for some people. When I interviewed Georgia, and I did Georgia's course for healthcare practitioners for ketogenic diets and mental health, and it was brilliant and well-researched. And, you know, I would recommend people go to diagnosisdiet.com as well and check out Georgia's stuff. But I asked her what was a win like traditional practice versus nutritional practice, and it's just like you say, you know, people's lives were massively improved by traditional practice, but people went into complete remission with nutrition. And that is quite startling. So there is a sort of psychological question about what is the resistance, why wouldn't someone be curious about that? And obviously there are reasons. I don't know if you'd want to guess, given maybe your experience of past medical colleagues.
Sure.
and how they reacted to kind of your adoption of low carb or keto as a treatment.
Yeah. Well, first I want to echo what you said about Georgia Eads training course. I mean, it's a great training course. So anybody who's interested in learning more about this and becoming trained in it should definitely check it out. I highly recommend it. I took it as well, and I think it's great. But you're right. There is a resistance, and part of it is, it's just baked into this decades of dogma of low fat diet is the healthy diet, right? The U.S. News and World Report ranking a keto diet as the worst diet you could go on, and this type of publicity is harmful because we're not talking about weight loss. Again, we're talking about a medical intervention, and even the way they evaluate those and rate those for weight loss is just so backwards. And so, this the food compass that came out from Tufts that, ranked Honey Nut Cheerios and Fruit Loops ahead of ground beef and fried eggs. And it's this bias against an omnivorous diet and bias against crazy to think about, but a whole foods diet that contains, animal products is still sort of biased against. And that's unfortunate because when you think about it as a medical intervention, it's not that. It's so powerful, and the information against it is just blatantly wrong. Unfortunately, it can hurt your kidneys. It'll hurt your bones. No, there's no evidence for any of that. Okay, well, it's going to give you heart disease. So that's the big remaining one that is going to give you heart disease. Well, what's interesting is if you look at the studies that have been done, in the majority of the studies for either weight loss or for treating type 2 diabetes, there's no statistical rise on average of LDL. And that's what everybody's concerned about. Oh, you're going to eat all that fat, your LDL is going to skyrocket, you're going to get a heart attack within weeks. There's no evidence of that, zero evidence of that. Now, some studies show maybe a 10% rise in LDL. But interestingly, one of those done by Virta Health showed that even though there was a 10% rise in LDL, the ApoB, which is the more important measurement, didn't change at all. And the calculated cardiovascular risk actually went down 12%. So that's where there's this disconnect that I think the medical field just isn't ready to see yet because we're so ingrained in LDL, unfortunately. So we need to look, further into it before saying it's automatically going to raise your LDL and cause your heart attack. Now, we have to acknowledge there's this group of hyper responders where LDL does go up quite a bit. And that's what everybody's afraid about. That's what doctors are afraid are going to happen to everybody. But I think it's pretty clear it's a small minority and not happening to everybody. And even then, the question is out of what does it mean? So, Dave Feldman, Matt Budoff, and colleagues are doing studies to look at it, which is great, right? It's one thing to talk about it, and it's another thing to actually design a study and do a study for it, which is amazing. And my hat's off to those guys for doing it. But the key is, it's this shallow perception of eating fat gives you a heart attack, period, end of discussion. And that's just, sure, maybe in the 1970s, people could believe that. 1980s, they could believe that without questioning it. But now there's just too much contrary evidence that has to be questioned. So I think that should open the door to more people being open to using a ketogenic diet, especially when you're using it as a medical intervention to treat a certain condition. I mean, look at seizures and epilepsy. It is a medical intervention that has randomized controlled trials, that has Cochrane reviews, that is in the guidelines for treating epilepsy because it works. It works as a medical intervention that changes the function of your brain. That's all we need to know, right? And it can be done safely and effectively. So, we need a medical medical treatment tends to change slowly, unfortunately, especially something that's been believed for decades and decades. But again, hopefully through proper education and in the way we discuss this, that we can start to make inroads there.
Yeah, the sort of glacial pace of new research, case studies, and so on, turning into bigger studies, and then replication, and then changing of the guidelines, and then changing what doctors actually do, that can take decades. And so empowering people to be able to make changes with responsible, knowledgeable people helping them is kind of a new sort of challenge, which I think goes along with the advent of this kind of communication where you and I can have a broadcastable piece of content. you know, maybe 20 years ago, it would be just people who could get on their local radio or national radio or television mm-hmm. who could talk about this sort of thing. 100 years ago, you see these things coming up from medical history on medical Twitter. People would maybe put out a pamphlet that might be able to help a couple of hundred people. Things are just changing now, aren't they? So there is something profoundly different about how we communicate this kind of thing. So I guess that gives hope, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to change the guidelines from the top down.
That's a great point. That's a great point. I mean, the way you described how you get to change guidelines and how long it takes and decades. Well, what about the people who are looking for a solution now, who are struggling to get their lives back now? Or just tell them to wait, you know, 15 years for the guidelines to change? No, they're looking for something now. And that you're exactly right. That's where this type of communication is so important for people to learn about this. But at the same time, how we phrase things is so important, because when people are you know, desperately seeking something, they want to hear keto solves everything. Just start keto and everything will be fine. You know, that's what people want to hear. But no, that can't be our message either, because that's not true. And so exactly like you said, starting it in a responsible way, in a safe way, properly managed and guided, to see if it's going to work, if it's going to help somebody, and to make sure that there aren't any adverse effects, which can happen, right? It has to be done in the proper way. But when it is, it can be such a powerful intervention. And we have so many people with lived experience talking about their experience that just shows that how you can change your life. And we can't wait for the guidelines to start talking about it.
Yeah, and you picked up on cardiovascular risk, and that is a strange one, isn't it? When you first hear or understand that, if you type in your LDL cholesterol with all your other blood lipids into the widely recognized legitimate risk calculators, LDL doesn't actually have that much of an impact, even though everyone thinks of it as like the bad cholesterol. So that's like, I suppose, a point about how risk is even explained to cardiologists, who then explain it to other people. But you know, thinking about these types of markers that give us a very clear understanding of risk, you know, for many people, mental health issues are kind of, you know, they retain this like air of sort of spooky Victorian asylums and stuff like that, because there's not much in the way of distinct physiological markers. There's a stigma attached to it because of that lack of understanding in a way. And I guess thinking about keto as a treatment for epilepsy, it's known that when it works, you typically need to be making ketones or have ketones in the body, but it's not then a direct linear correlation between how well you feel and how many ketones you have. So there's still a sort of slight lack of mechanistic understanding of exactly why it can help people. Where do you think the science is going here?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a really good question. You know, is a ketone level of 0.7 different than 2.5? Is that going to make a difference in how well you treat seizures or how well you treat psychiatric symptoms or mental illness? And that's unknown. But, you know, thankfully, there are a lot of trials underway right now, in large part thanks to the Baszucki Brain Research Fund, which is helping fund 5 pilot trials about ketogenic interventions for serious mental illness, and more to come. So I don't think these 5 pilot trials are going to answer every question like you brought up about the degree of ketosis. Like, I want to see further trials looking at Mediterranean diet, keto diet, and then keto plus exogenous ketones, you know, looking at ketone levels of 1 versus ketone levels of 3, and, you know, all those nuances that need to come out. But when a field is sort of brand new like this is, it does take a little time to get there. But those are some really interesting unanswered questions. And, you know, we could hopefully get those questions answered in the seizure world, the epilepsy world, and the mental health world. But, you know, I had a great conversation with Dr. Julie Milder, who's the associate science director at Baszucki Group. And she has an extensive background in the epilepsy world. And she said she, you know, the studies that have used exogenous ketones as solitary intervention haven't had the same effect as using a ketogenic diet. So it appears there's something there. Now, I don't think there are you know, a ton of studies that have looked at it. I think there are very few studies that looked at it, so more needs to be done. But the suggestion is there is something about the nutrition which would go down to, you know, the insulin resistance and the metabolic metabolic improvements, because just giving ketones isn't going to improve your metabolism, but it'll raise your ketone level. So it's probably that combination that really has the best effect. You know, hypothesis going off a little bit of research, but that's what it seems to suggest. And so we'll see what future trials show. But the research in this field is fairly strong for such a young field and increasing pretty significantly, again, because of conversations like what we're having right now, because of curious researchers out there who are interested in being on the forefront of a new field, because of private funding, right? Again, pharma is not funding these trials. So we have to get sort of private funding for a lot of these trials. But now that that's happening, the research is happening. We're going to learn so much more in the upcoming years.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very exciting. There's a couple of points that I want to pick up on there. The first is with the exogenous ketones, you know, where maybe you have like a powder that you dissolve into water or a drink and then you drink it. And I tried some of these from Keto Swiss, Dr. Elena Gross, who's a Swiss researcher, who I think they're starting to sell them in America soon. They're not allowed to sell them in Europe at the moment. But I could feel an effect on my brain, I think. It might have been placebo, but I think I could feel it. Mm-hmm. Felt mentally sharper. And I'm already in ketosis most of the time. So that was interesting. And obviously people have these experiences. Like you say, in epilepsy, the effect isn't as strong as if you have changed your diet and lifestyle as well. But then there's situations like Elena pointed out to me where maybe someone is feels mentally in a place that they can't really control their diet properly, or maybe that's someone who's elderly or infirm. And it's I kind of think sometimes like there's a positive threshold for feeling good mentally, and you sort of build the blocks up to try and push yourself over that threshold line, and exogenous ketones can be a part of that, right? Which is, mm-hmm. I guess, is the point you were making. And there's various situations where it could come in handy.
Yeah, I think they have a role in certain situations, absolutely. But again, it can get boiled down to, oh, just drink this thing and you'll be fine. It'll treat everything, right? We can't make it that simplistic, because that's not the case. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like where ideologies meet clinical practice somehow. You know, mm-hmm. I know George has had some success with people who maybe don't have the cooking skills or the mobility or dexterity, and maybe rely on shakes a little bit for some of their food, and then other times get some food delivered, and that kind of thing can be really helpful. And the other thing I wanted to pick up on was how, if you're talking about stratifying these studies into, you know, different dietary modes, one thing that really gets to me is how high fat diet, HFD, is used as a single term to mean any high fat diet, where of course you look down into the study and actually it's soybean oil and high starch, but they call it a high fat diet even though it comes with all this other stuff. So it'd be great to see and understand how the stratification of fat types can affect mental health. And I asked this question of Dominic D'Agostino on Twitter, and I think it's something he would like to see too. He particularly thinks the omega-3 to omega-6 ratios could make an interesting difference. I would obviously like to see, you know, an infinite number, I suppose, in that space. But what's your thoughts on that, you know, given that the brain is such a fatty organ?
Yeah, I mean, there is good research that omega-3s and, you know, DHA is very impactful on the brain. So I think there could be something there about that omega-3 to omega-6 ratio on brain function. That would be interesting to see. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the way the literature refers to high fat diet is just incorrect, or not incorrect, but just misleading. And same for low carb diet, right? Like studies that show low carb diets are harmful, and they're 40% of their calories as carbs is defined as low carb. This is incorrect classification that is incredibly misleading. So we do have to be more precise in how we define things. But I think you're right. The types of fat matter. The types of carbs matter. The you know, the dietary structure matters. All these details are likely going to matter. Now, we don't have enough research to say with certainty exactly what impact they have and what is the right omega-3, omega-6 ratio. And we don't know those details. But it just makes sense to follow a more natural whole foods approach, which is going to have higher omega-3s and lower omega-6s for the most part, or your omega-6s are going to come from fish and nuts and, you know, food sources rather than processed oils. And it just makes sense, even if we don't have the clear research to say this is the way we all have to eat. To me, it just makes sense, and it's what I would recommend.
Big part of coaching for me is trying to kind of allay people's fears at the start that I'm going to tell them what to do. It's almost mm-hmm. the opposite, you know, and there's a sort of visible sigh of relief oftentimes when I say, what do you really like to eat? And then they tell me, and then I say, well, why don't you eat that? And I feel like the personalization of any type of diet is so important for sustainability. And so yeah. I'm interested to know what you think about the range of workable keto diets and also, you know, what you eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great point, that a keto diet isn't one thing, right? You could have vegan keto, vegetarian keto, you could have carnivore, you could have Mediterranean keto, you could have, you know, Italian keto, you could have Mexican and Indian, like all these different cuisines fit into a keto diet. And that's what's, I think, so beneficial for it, that it can work in different cultures, it can work with different people. Now, it's more challenging, the more carb heavy the culture is, the more challenging it can become, but by no means is that an absolute barrier to it. So I think you're right about, you know, meeting the patients where they are. And if you say you have to eat steak and bacon and eggs and cream, and that's the only way to do it, then you're going to lose a ton of people, as opposed to say, show me your meals, show me what you're eating now. Let's find some keto alternatives to these that keep the taste, that keep the enjoyment. Because we're emotional, and food is emotional for us, and food is pleasurable for us. If all we did was, you know, in those, some of those science fiction movies or whatever, where they just pop a square of nutrients into their mouth and that's it, and they're done eating, that'd be a lot simpler. But that's not the life we live, right? So we have to realize that connection. And then that's a great way for a coach to work. Again, not to say you have to eat this way, but to help them keep the enjoyment that they have, but do it in a way that's healthier for them. So I think that's great. Now, part of that was, what do I eat? For me, I keep it pretty simple. I always joked when I was working at Diet Doctor, people would ask me what were my favorite recipes and which ones did I use. And they'd be like, look, I gotta be honest, I'm not really a recipe kind of guy. I grill a couple steaks and steam a ton of vegetables and slice up an avocado, put some olive oil. That's my dinner. My lunch the next day is the leftover steak, the leftover veggies, and some eggs and cheese. That's my lunch. And then dinner the next day is some salmon with the veggies, the avocado, olive oil. So some people listen to that and be like, wow, that's really boring. But for me, that's what works. And I really enjoy it. I enjoy the mix, and I enjoy keeping it simple. I always have a big glass tin of leftover veggies and another one of leftover proteins. And those are my lunches. And you know, do it over the next day for dinner. And it doesn't have to be complicated. And I find it delicious. Enough salt and olive oil and cheese, and it's delicious. Like, what's there to argue with? So for me, that works.
Yeah, that's kind of how, you know, my life is too. And I think when people are switching over, there's a temptation to kind of Google it and find a million recipes. And I guess instead of saying, oh, well, I can take five of these and make them my go-tos, they think, oh, I need to do a different recipe for every meal for the rest of my life. And I guess, like, before I ate keto, I probably only had three or four go-tos that I would do on a regular basis. And it's the same with keto. Yeah. It's just different. It's just slightly different foods.
Right. Yeah,
is there anything that you have to avoid because it gives you particular issues?
Well, I get like craving issues, you know, like peanut butter is a thing for me. my treat at the end of the day might be some berries and peanut butter and cottage cheese or something. And for me, that's something that I could just keep going back for more and more and more and more. So yeah, that's kind of my little treat that I have to ward against eating too much of, I guess. Yeah. But you know, my you know, any sweet tooth or sweet cravings, those disappeared right away when I went on keto and sort of never came back, which I guess I'm pretty lucky because I know not everybody feels that way. Like this sugar addiction and sweet taste addiction is a real thing. And some people really battle with that on a regular basis with keto. But I'm fortunate not for me. And that's where, you know, the erythritol products and the monk fruit products, where they can play a role as long as they're not, you know, triggering more cravings and eating more, as long as you can use it as a tool to sort of just quell that little sweet tooth a little bit and then cut it off, that could be really helpful for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be a bridge away from the worst things. You know, I sell a sugar-free chocolate, and I sometimes describe it as like a methadone for sugar addicts.
It's a good description. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a thing recently. A doctor was on social media and TV in the States saying that the number one cause of obesity is genetics. And, you know, she went as far as to say, yeah, if you're born to parents with obesity, you have a 50 to 85% likelihood of having the disease yourself, even with optimal diet, exercise, sleep management, stress management. And that's verbatim. I'm quoting her. I mean, do you even want to talk about this statement very much and how it might, what it might imply for mental health?
Well, look, I think the statement by itself is egregious, but the fact that if we're talking about the same doctor, she's on the Dietary Guidelines Committee. Like, that's what scares me. She's on the Dietary Guidelines Committee, and her approach is diet doesn't matter because you're destined to be obese if you have the genes. And wow, I just think that's so short-sighted. And really looking at research with focused lenses on. I think, you know, maybe she sees what she's looking for, as opposed to recognizing that obesity is a multimodality problem. And genetics play a role, right? There's no question there are genes that can make you more susceptible, but it's the epigenetic expression, it's how you live your life that is far more impactful. Like, how can people, you know, with skinny parents end up being obese, and how can people with obese parents end up being skinny, and people who were once obese are now skinny? And like, you don't change your genes. Those people's genes are not changing. They're changing their lifestyle and what they do. And that's what research shows as well. So that really worries me, that someone like that is now in a position who's going to help the government decide how we should eat. That's the concerning part for me there.
Yeah, I heard someone at the obesity.
We started on the guidelines. I mean, the fact that the government has any role in telling us what we eat, I think is just horrific and just so dangerous in so many ways, but that's a whole nother story.
Yeah, it kind of makes me wonder about someone whose name escapes me at the moment. I saw a speak at the obesity conference that John Speakman organized in London in October, and it was a lot of really thought-provoking talks. One of them was about taking the agency, the sort of accusation of lack of willpower off of people and putting it on to entities, so corporations, governments, so on, to change the environment, because humans find it hard to change their habits given such an obesogenic environment. So, you know, should government get involved there, or should, you know, we be voting with our feet and, you know, trying to stop buying ultra-processed food? Is it about people like us who are communicating to just communicate harder and better and more? And, you know, obviously it's a complicated question, but where do you see are the sort of easy wins there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point. And I mean, this opens a whole nother layer of where does government get involved. But you brought up a good point that there's a fine line between blaming the individual and saying this is your fault versus absolving them of any blame, but they're therefore also saying there's not much you can do to control it, right? It's your genes, it's the companies. You don't have to do anything differently. Let us address them. those are two extremes that neither one is correct. Like, you can give someone agency, you can give someone power, let them know this is something they can change without making it their fault. I mean, we're living in an environment where the deck is stacked against us. We have to realize that. So it is hard. It is hard for people to make these individual changes and individual choices within the society, but it is possible to do. And especially when we're not just talking about, you know, losing 10 pounds, but we're talking about, you know, your type 2 diabetes that is going to put you at risk for heart disease and amputations and blindness. And we're talking about serious mental illness that is robbing you of your quality of life and your families and your caretakers and, you know, is taking you away from the life you could be living. Like, we're talking about serious medical conditions that can be reversed and put into remission. But to tell someone there's nothing you can do about it, it's just your genes, it's just awful. Like, we have to make people understand they can control this, but that doesn't mean it's their fault that they're in this position. And I think that, unfortunately, is a false dichotomy that's sort of set up in the way we talk about it too often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree completely. Can you briefly go over, because I want to finish with you talking about metabolic mind a bit more in depth, but maybe could you just talk us through Dr. Danon's study in France quickly?
Yeah, that was a great study. So Dr. Danon has a outpatient and inpatient psychiatric clinic in France. And what he did was he took 31 of his patients who he had been working with for years and who hadn't been getting better. So they were refractory, whether it was schizophrenia or bipolar or major depression. And he put them all in the hospital and fed them a keto diet. And that was the only intervention. Everything else stayed the same. But he fed them a ketogenic diet in a controlled hospital setting. And everybody improved to some degree. And I apologize, I forget the exact statistic, but it was like almost half were able to reduce their medications, but everybody's symptoms improved. And it was, when you look at the scores that he used, like the HAM-D score and the PNAS score, it was significant improvements in their functioning and their quality of life. And the only intervention was changing what they ate. That was the only intervention. So, I mean, really impressive. Again, not a randomized controlled trial, but you have to start somewhere. And so to use this as the basis of saying, wow, look what this one doctor accomplished in his practice. Again, why wouldn't other doctors want to try this to accomplish this? And hopefully researchers will then say, wow, look at this. We need to study this more and figure out more about this, because it was such a powerful intervention, which didn't really take much. And so he showed it was safe and it was effective to do, and really should open the doors to a lot of people being interested in this because it was so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very exciting. And so finally, back around to metabolic mind, I've been enjoying the YouTube videos that you've been putting up, and it's just Metabolic Mind on YouTube, the channel. I would urge everyone to go and subscribe. But what is it exactly you're trying to do with it and the more wide Metabolic Mind project?
Yeah, I mean, we want to start off by educating the world. You know, it was started, Metabolic Mind is a nonprofit initiative of Bazooki Group, which is led by Jan and Dave Bazooki. Basically based upon their son, Matt, who's been very vocal about what he's gone through with his bipolar disorder, but really becoming well for the first time, being able to live a normal life with no stigma of mental illness after starting a ketogenic diet and really focusing on his metabolic health. And this is, they're directing a lot of their philanthropic energy towards this idea, this education for people. So that's what we're starting with at Metabolic Mind under YouTube. Because one thing Jan has said numerous times is this is what she wanted when she was trying to figure out what could she do to help her son. She needed one place that could come to show her this connection between metabolic and mental health, to walk her through, you know, using the keto.
Where else can you find Metabolic Mind?
We're on Twitter at metabolic_mind. Those are our two main sources right now. And of course, our website, metabolicmind.org. Those are the main things, our YouTube page, Twitter, and our website. And we're trying to, you know, put our information all over those places. So wherever you look, you'll be able to learn something, and find us so we can help you on your journey. And we want feedback, right? Like just like Jan said, these are the resources she wanted as she was going through this. We want to hear from people. What are the resources they want? How else we can help them? Because we want to, you know, adapt and adjust to help people as best we can.
And will the resources be kind of passively offered, or will there be other types of delivery of information or resources? Is it going to be mainly videos and on the YouTube channel, or what else do you have up your sleeve, do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question. Like I said, we're about, you know, 2 or 3 months old at this point at the recording of this. So exactly what we're going to look like a year from now, we don't know. But that's part of what we want to do, to adjust to give people what they need. So sure, we're going to look for other modes of delivering our information. And it's just not our, it's not just our information, right? We're promoting Georgia Ede and her amazing website, and Dr. Chris Palmer and his incredible book, and Dr. Shivani Sethi and Judy Ford and their papers that they've written. We want to promote everybody else's work that they're doing as well. So right, it's not just our own content, it's everybody else's content. So working on these collaborations and how to, you know, the rising tide lift all boats analogy. So what we look like in a year, I don't know, but it's going to be pretty exciting. And I know we're going to have a lot more information in a lot of ways for people to learn about it. And hopefully even a podcast coming soon. You know, I really enjoyed having the Diet Doctor podcast and speaking on other people's podcasts like yours. So hopefully we'll have a Metabolic Mind podcast coming too as well.
Fantastic. Well, I really appreciate everything you've done, everything you're doing, and for your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on, and thanks for all you're doing. And I'm really excited to see more about your coaching program with Dr. Brown. That's really exciting.
Thanks, Brett.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks. See you next time.